This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
Well, you probably realize this already, but we tend to underestimate the huge influence that the advertising industry has on us. The impact of their message of materialism and consumerism is easily bought, and it's embraced by so many of us. We see an advertisement for something, and we actually believe what the advertisements are promising. So, or maybe we don't, because we're jaded. But one writer described it this way, that bigger is better. Bigger cars, bigger houses, and of course, bigger paychecks. And this isn't just like a recent phenomenon. Before Mad Men was on TV and the advertising industry, we got some insight into that. Whatever, if that's for you, you know what it means. But 1940 Oldsmobile advertisement came right out and said, bigger and better to look at, bigger and better to drive. 1940 Oldsmobile. Or in 1965, an ad said, so you told your barber you're not getting color TV until they make a bigger picture. Better get a new story or a Philco. That's evidently a color TV from the 60s, 1965. In the soft drink wars, if you look at old Pepsi advertisements, they actually put on their signs, bigger and better. And then this kind of dates the ad, worth a dime, but only costs a nickel. Those were the days, right? So this isn't just a new phenomenon, but it certainly does come into this world. It continues to make our way into our psyche. It all seems well and good, and we might not even think that we're influenced by that, but the big question we have to deal with is, does having all the bigger and better stuff really lead to greater joy? Does having all the bigger and better stuff really lead to greater joy? So do you ever check what your heart is craving? Do you ever dig into that? Are your desires ever held in check when you want something? Again, it's amazing that the advertising industry has learned that the way to our spending is through our desires. They make us want something. This happens, like adults, we've tempered this. Like, we don't just come right out and say, oh, I want that. But if you ever watch TV with your kids, like let's say we're watching the Disney Channel, and an advertisement will come up for some toy that could be destroyed in my house in like 30 seconds. And that advertisement will say, you know, da, 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 and do this, and fire at one another, bee, 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 and all this, whatever. And then, like, one of my kids will say out loud, like, oh, I want that. Oh, I gotta have that. So we easily justify really any kind of behavior because we want it. That's what's driving most of our actions. And we gloss all that over in, like, real nice religious language, like, well, I've prayed about this, and I have a peace about it, and, you know, God seems to be leading in this, but God, really, it just boils down to the fact that we want it and therefore we're going to get it. We want to do this, so therefore we're going to do it, right? So rather than just going with it, we have to hold this in check. And this is part of the wisdom that we're learning in the book of Ecclesiastes. So you might remember last week, if you weren't here last week, we introduced this book. So you might have thought, what happened to 1 Peter? That was like 2 weeks ago. We are now in a new book, and we are deep into it, and we're going to be done like in 5 weeks. So it's just, yeah. The theme for these few weeks that we're going to be in Ecclesiastes is the joy of fearing God under the sun. That's really kind of the book in a nutshell. And in this life, we're given some joys, and they find full expression in fearing God. We'll get there eventually at the end of the book. So some of you came up last time, after last week's sermon and said, yeah, well, really, we can have hope because of this. Yep, we're going to get there. But to allow the message of this book to land, like, I'm not giving away all the end story yet, because this book just needs to land on us. And like I said last week, take time and just read this book. Let the message just steep in your soul. So you can just read 2 chapters a day starting tomorrow, and you can be done by next Sunday. So you could read 1 and 2, then 3 and 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and be done on Saturday if you just read 2 chapters a day. So we jumped into this book last week, really with those first 11 verses. and we began to see some themes emerge. We saw a common theme of vanity. You might see that if you look in your Bibles up in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And if you're keeping track, that's 7 times he says vanity in one verse. And I asked you to substitute soap bubbles every time you see vanity, because soap bubbles is a great way of helping you think about what's going on there. It's soap bubbles, if you do dishes, they're those things that pop up when you put the soap in the water, and then they're so shiny, and if the sun's coming in, they maybe have a rainbow on them. There's that purple illusion hovering over it. It's a beautiful thing, and then it pops, and it's gone. And that's what vanity's like. That's what this theme of vanity's like. It really comes from the Hebrew word that's like breath, or like when you blow out on a cold day, like today's going to be, by the end of the day, you'll exhale and you'll be able to see your breath. That's what vanity's like, because it disappears. Your breath doesn't stay there like a cloud, unless it's really bad breath. No, it just goes away. It's vanity. It's vanity. So vanity is something that's not living up to its intended purpose. When something is described as vanity in Ecclesiastes, the writer is using that word to refer to things or situations which are vain or pointless, in the sense of they fail to achieve what we expect, or they're absurd in the sense of contradicting all reasonable expectation. That's a definition from Eric Ortlund. So vain and pointless, or absurd. They're not living up to expectation. It's just vanity. So in chapter 1, then, as we kept making our way through those opening verses, in verse 3, a big question was thrown out there. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So what's the benefit? What does man gain from that? And last week, the sermon answered that question by answering empty. There's not really much that a man gains from all his toil under the sun. It's empty because we follow the pattern of creation, and there's nothing new in our human world. That was the outline from last week. So today our writer is going to dig in and actually do some boots on the ground work, seeking to understand what gain there is for our toil. Now the investigation's fully launched. Last week we were kind of given, kind of, this is where he expects it's going to go, that there's nothing new in this human world, and creation's kind of, we follow the pattern of creation, but now we're actually going to get into the investigation, all the way to the end of chapter 2. And this investigation is going to help us learn something, give a hint for the high purpose for living that God has for us. And so my hope is that by the end of this investigation today, you'd be able to see your toil, the work you do, through a lens of God-centeredness. That's really what we're after today. And if you're here today and you're maybe wondering about big purpose of life questions, like, what am I here for? Why do I do what I do? What's the purpose of school? What's the purpose of my work? It just seems so monotonous. What's going on here? There might not be a better passage in the Bible at driving you to see through how all the things that our world are saying is true about life, how empty they really are. So the world is saying, oh, you know, you can do this in yourself. Just think better thoughts and it's going to be okay. And the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying, this world just stinks. I mean, there's not much good happening here. All the good stuff you do, you'll see this jaded approach almost as we work through these verses this morning. And you're going to hear a common refrain, different answers to the gain of toil, and you're going to hear a common refrain that this too was vanity and striving after the wind. It's vanity. It's empty. It doesn't live up to its intended purpose. So I don't know if you've ever tried chasing the wind. But if I sent us all out there today and say, we're going to go catch the wind, some of you would be like, that's okay, I don't need to go. But if you were actually going to try, it would just be an impossible thing, right? Chasing the wind. So if you're able to see that, able to see what you already feel in this book, there are a few things in this life that pass the vanity test. There are a few things in this life that are not chasing after the wind. And so I hope you can reach that same conclusion that the writer does at the end and see a God-centered outlook for your life. And if you're already claiming that God-centered outlook for your life, this passage is a great reminder for you to not get too caught up in the stuff of this world. So I saw something last night like, why are you so anxious about a job that if you died, you could be replaced in a week with? you know, why are you killing yourself on that job? And it's that kind of perspective, right? There's nothing new under the sun. It's vanity. It's striving after the wind. So there's a reminder here to not get too caught up in the stuff of this world. Things you might be able to purchase will not satisfy you. I mean, they're exhilarating for the moment. I mean, every time there's a new Apple product announcement, I mean, I'm like glued watching, what are they going to do? This is so incredible. Oh, it's going to make life so much easier. And then we download it, and it's like, when's the next meeting? I'm anxious for something new. I'm so discontent with all this. So be careful. Be wary of yourself. Be careful with what you crave and how you might be justifying choices and behaviors to really just serve yourself. That's the issue. God's got bigger plans than your little plans, right? God's got bigger plans for your life than just what you can come up with. And that's what we're going to dig into in this passage. So, all that by way of introduction, then, I want to invite you to join me as we see three investigations into the toil of life. Three investigations. And let's begin by reading Ecclesiastes 1, verses 12 through 18. So let's start reading there, and then we'll keep digging through the rest of the passage as we go through everything. So here's what we read, beginning in verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that's done under heaven. It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. What's crooked cannot be made straight, and what's lacking cannot be counted. And I said in my heart, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceived that this also is but a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So three investigations into the toil of life. And first of all, the first investigation we see, we begin by seeing that the pursuit of wisdom does not satisfy. The pursuit of wisdom, that's really what he's saying in chapter 1 there. We jump into these 33 verses we're going to look at today, and we're introduced to the nature of our investigation, right? Who is it? Well, in verse 12 there, Solomon, the preacher, he had been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And he gave himself to seek out and to search out by wisdom all that's done under heaven. And he's looking for these things. And he gave himself to that quest. And like it says in verse 13 there, I applied my heart to this quest. He's speaking of applying his heart. He's not just saying like, I really gave my all to this quest. He's saying that it was, heart is his way of saying it's who he is. Everything about him was pursuing this quest. The heart is bigger than mere emotions in the Old Testament. It's the heart that's driving actions. It's the heart that is propelling him forward in this investigation. And he's pursuing, I mean, here's the category, everything that's done under heaven. So it's pretty amazing, right? This helps us see that under the sun and under heaven, these concepts are describing our life here on earth, under heaven, under the sun. The life in the here and now. This is what he's investigating. And some bubbles need to be burst when we think about our life here under the sun. And the big banner is there at verse 13. Here's the good news at the end of verse 13. It's an unhappy business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. Thanks for that. Yeah, it's an unhappy business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. So all that he's going to show in these coming verses is that true? Is it really an unhappy business? Or is this guy just kind of an old man that needs a nap? I mean, what's going on here? Is he just kind of grouchy? What's going on? Really? It's an unhappy business? We're going to see if that's true. Verse 14 elaborates more on this. It's kind of introducing the quest on why that statement can be made. The preacher says, I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. That's why he's saying it's an unhappy business. That he's saying, I've investigated it all that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. So this is the investigation. He's pursuing everything that's done under the sun. And his conclusion, again, is that it's vanity. It fails to achieve what we expect it would. It's a chasing after the wind. So 9 times in the first half of this book, he's going to use this phrase, striving after the wind or chasing after the wind. It's a vain pursuit. In verse 15, we have a proverb that's thrown out there, giving another reason for these conclusions he's just made in verses 13 and 14, that what is crooked cannot be made straight. What's lacking cannot be counted. One writer's saying, like paraphrasing this, and says, the chaotic can't be ordered. The one lacking knowledge can't be supplied with it. That's what the proverb is. Or another, the perverse are hard to be corrected, and the number of fools is infinite. Have you experienced anything like that in life? Like where there's people around you, you're like, these people just do not get it. I've had people say that to me, like in frustration. These people just do not get it. Or, you know, you just can't teach an old dog new tricks. That's what he's throwing in here as proof. He's appealing, like, crooked can't be made straight. What's lacking can't be counted. You know? Bumpy roads just can't be repaved, no matter what Domino's says. They're just going to be bumpy again someday. And in verse 16, Solomon was uniquely qualified for this pursuit, right? In verse 16, he says, I've acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, right? We know that's the case for Solomon. God gave Solomon wisdom, and it was renowned in the ancient world. Other people would come and benefit from that, right? And he actively sought more knowledge and more wisdom. He went after it. He sought out madness and folly. Look at this in verse 17. I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. So what does it mean to this triad of, he's pursuing wisdom and then he goes after madness and folly? Well, madness, I think, is speaking of how easily distracted we become when we seek wisdom or knowledge. So, right? I mean, you just, okay, I really need to focus and get this. Oh, what's the score in that game? Look at that. We're just easily distracted. That's the madness, right? So as Solomon's pursuing the wisdom and knowledge, he's easily distracted, and it's madness. I need to focus. I need to grow. My life needs to change. I got to apply myself here. And what's the score of that game again? Or, you know, what's that person doing? Or, you know, we're just easily distracted. That's the madness. And the folly speaks to our understanding of it, right? So even if we know the wise path or the way that makes the most sense, we don't always take it. You know, most of us in this room, I mean, we've been in church life enough to know that there's a right and a wrong thing to do, and yet so often we still choose the wrong thing to do. That's the folly. It's not necessarily just an information problem. It's a heart issue. There's folly. We just easily go after what we know is not the wise path. So then Solomon concludes, this also is a striving after the wind. It's like a chase or a fight that you can't win. Wisdom leads to vexation, right? That's verse 18. For much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So wisdom leads to vexation in that sense. We're quickly disillusioned by the actions of others, as well as our inability to walk in the way that we should. The more knowledge we get, the more it increases sorrow. So, yeah, Schoolhouse Rock was right. Knowledge is power. And this gets to the idea of knowing the right way and not walking in it. Knowing truth just affects, it leads to vexation. It increases sorrow. Knowing the right way and not walking in it. So this is a great insight. Because a lot of us in this room, you might even think, well, if people just had the right kind of information, it would make all the difference in their lives. And Solomon's saying, nope. No, it wouldn't make a difference in their lives. Because more wisdom leads to vexation. More knowledge leads to sorrow. That's not the end. The answer at the end of the day is not just wisdom or information. Now, I have to give a caveat here because the way the writer of Ecclesiastes is using wisdom is not like how the writer of Proverbs is using wisdom or like the wisdom literature as a whole is handling that. Elsewhere in the Bible's wisdom literature, we'll be called to a way of wisdom that centers on fearing God. And the way of wisdom that he's talking about is here is pursuing wisdom as the end or pursuing knowledge as the aim. And he's saying that's not going to satisfy. It's vanity. It's a striving after the wind. It's found wanting. So, this is the investigation where it begins, that wisdom does not satisfy. It doesn't help. The pursuit of wisdom does not satisfy. So as we make our way into chapter 2, we're given a second investigation, or a second aspect, a second phase of this investigation. There's a toil in life in seeing that the pursuit of pleasures is fleeting. Not only does wisdom not satisfy, the pursuit of pleasures is fleeting. So this is in 2 verses 1 through 11. Let me read that as we keep making our way through here. And just listen to what he's saying here. Here's what the writer says. I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad, and of pleasure, what use of it is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity, and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So the pursuit of pleasures is fleeting. We know this is another section, by the way, because they're kind of all broken down with this speaking from the heart. Like, I spoke from my heart in verse 12 and 13. I applied my heart. Now I said in my heart. And then there's another break in verse 16. Or that's like in chapter 1, verse 16. And the test here is with pleasure, encouraging the pursuit of enjoyment. And the conclusion reached was this is a vanity. So look at these great pursuits beginning in verse 2. Seeing this is vanity led him to call laughter madness, called pleasure useless. So he searched for ways to cheer his body. He tried strong drink. He thought he could lay hold of folly. And his aim again was to see if there was any good for the children of men to do under heaven during their few days on earth. So do you get what he's saying there in verse 3, at the end of verse 3? That your days are numbered. There's just a few days that you have on this earth. Our life on earth is a measured thing. It's just a few days in light of eternity. So how are you going to live in light of that? And so what did he do? Well, I got a short amount of time to live, therefore I'm going to pursue this with all my heart. And so verse 4, I made great works, houses and vineyards. Verse 5, I made gardens, parks, and I filled them with fruit trees. Verse 6, I made pools of water to feed those trees. Verse 7, I had all kinds of servants. I had herds, flocks, and all kinds of material possessions. Verse 8, silver, gold, and all the luxuries that went with being king. I think what's going on in verse 8 is you might think, well, of course, he's a king. He's got all this stuff. And what he's saying in verse 8 is, not only did I have all the stuff the king had, but this was kind of like my personal property. Like I amassed so much that this I had all kinds of luxuries that were even beyond what kings would have. And then he says, I got singers and concubines in verse 8. What's a concubine? Silence? Let me just word it this way, because there's children in the room. Solomon had hundreds of wives and concubines. So he's saying that he was a busy man. So I'm calling these great pursuits, not in the sense of great as in the morality of them being good, but great in terms of the depth to which he pursued these, right? I mean, can you imagine hanging out with him just in an evening? Now, hold on a second. We're going to plant another forest over here. Watch this, you know, or just whatever. I mean, just amassing this kind of life. And what's the conclusion he reaches in verses 9 through 11? That there was nothing gained under the sun. He became great, and there was no one like him before in Jerusalem. He still had his wisdom with him. Whatever his eyes wanted, he did. He kept his heart from no pleasure. His heart found pleasure, and so, in other words, some of these things, they were pleasurable, but that was all the reward that there were. Just in the moment, yeah, okay, that's pleasurable. That's the reward. It was a fleeting pleasure, in other words. It lasted for just a moment, and then it was gone. It didn't satisfy. And so in verse 11, he considers the work of his hands, the toil and the energy, and it was vanity, striving after the wind, nothing gained under the sun. So the pursuit of pleasure wasn't sufficient. Where was God in verses 1 through 11 of chapter 2? Did you see him anywhere there? Yeah, God's nowhere to be seen. So in these verses, this preacher is describing that he made gardens. I mean, I think it almost is like helping us think, man, you really do think you were hot stuff. Like, it's almost as if like he's creating another Eden without God, right? He's creating a place that's going to satisfy him. Great works, planting houses, planting vineyards, gardens, parks, planting these things. And maybe like some of you in this room, you may think that you can live your life without God and still enjoy lasting pleasure. And the writer here is saying that I've pursued that way beyond anything you will ever do, and it's never enough. It's fleeting. It doesn't satisfy. So it's a great warning. It's a great just jolt to our system that it doesn't matter what stuff I get, it's never going to be enough. It's never going to be enough. Well, this leads to the third and final part of the investigation in verses 12 through 26. So let me read that and then we'll come back and unpack it and then be done. Beginning in verse 12. So he's investigated wisdom, he's investigated pleasures, and now in verse 12. So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can a man do who comes after the king? Only what's already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so wise? And I said in my heart that this also is a vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there's no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and striving after the wind. And I hated all my toil, in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave up my heart to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who's toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is a vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his heart is a vexation, his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart doesn't rest. This also is a vanity. So here's the conclusion. This is what we got to get to in verses 24 through 26, where he kind of comes to his senses and says, there's nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases God, to pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he's given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity. and a striving after wind. So, this third part of the investigation where it comes kind of full circle, we've pursued wisdom, wisdom doesn't satisfy, we've pursued pleasures, they're fleeting, and now he's saying that toil without God leads to emptiness. It's empty. Toil without a view of God leads to emptiness. So before we get to the conclusion there in verses 24 through 26, the writer digs into the problem of death, right? So that was verses 12 through 17, specifically in verse 12. So considering wisdom, madness, and folly, he asks the question, what can the man do who comes after the king? In other words, the writer all of a sudden starts to think, I'm not going to be here forever. I've tried everything. I mean, I've pursued everything. I've given my heart to this. I have wisdom, madness, folly. I've pursued all this. And what do I have to show for it? In other words, I'm going to die someday, and what's going to happen? And all that's left is what's already been done. So he reaches a conclusion in verse 13. I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there's more gain in light than in darkness. The wise have eyes, but the fool doesn't, walking in darkness. So he's saying there's a benefit in being wise, right? But the same event, death, happens to you whether you're wise or a fool. And therefore, posturing yourself as better than others because of your wisdom is vanity. So, I mean, that's a real temptation, right? So some of you in this room are thinking, yeah, I got this. I'm way better than those in the world who are just foolish. I have biblical wisdom on my side. That's what I'm trying to walk in. And Solomon here in verses 13 and 14 is saying, yeah, but you're going to die too, right? You can't even take that with you, the fact that you were wise. You're going to die. The wise die like the fool. And the remembrance of your life will inevitably pass. So he concludes in verse 17, so what do? I hated life. Because what is done to the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and striving after the wind. He's looking back at all that, thinking about how he's going to die, and he's thinking, God, I hate this. It's grievous. So, death is coming. Death is coming, and it should affect you. One writer powerfully said that if death doesn't inform the way you live, then death is something that we're pretending doesn't exist. So if you can go through life without ever thinking about the fact that you're not going to be here, the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying, then you're acting as if that doesn't exist. So there's a wisdom in thinking about death. And as the writer's thinking about this and hating life, he begins to think about all the toil that he's done under the sun, right? So he's kind of, this is kind of like the dreamy scene of Godfather Part 2. So he's thinking back to a previous life. He's remembering all this. So here's the life that I've put together. I'm going to die, but I'm putting this life, here's what I'm thinking about. I hated my toil, verse 18, toiling under the sun, wondering to whom it's going to be left. Will that person be a wise person or will that person be a fool? And what about coming generations? So all that toil and laboring that you've done with your wisdom is going to go to others. And that's going to be a vanity. He's saying this is vanity. So the preacher thought, well, if I can't fix the way they live, then I know I'll just despair in verse 20. And he found a vanity and a great evil in the ability to not keep what he had worked for. And you might feel that too. You may feel like you've put together a strong body of work. So like the generation that came before my generation, just working so hard so their kids could have so much. And he's saying, what if you look at that and your kids are just fools or wise? I mean, you don't know. You can't live life for them. You've already lived. So he's not happy about this. He's despairing. And he reaches some conclusions there in verses 22-23. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart from which he toils beneath the sun? In other words, what What do we get out of all this labor and work? And look at verse 23. All his days are full of sorrow, full of evil. His work is a vexation, and even in the night his heart doesn't rest. This also is vanity. So when you work hard, you know what that gets you? You have to put up with people, and the days are evil. Work is going to be a pain, and you're even going to take it with you to sleep. You're not going to be able to sleep well. So we don't get much of anything toiling under the sun, do we? So what's the point? So all of this, all of these 30 verses that we've walked through, you might think, man, I'm barely hanging on here. Give me something, okay? I can feel that. It just seems, because we don't think about things like this. Even in the Christian world, we don't think about this. We're not honest about life the way the writer of Ecclesiastes is. And he's saying what we all feel. I mean, those of you that have reached retirement age, you're thinking, yeah, man, you can look back in your life and think times when you were stressed out and how work was so difficult and you were sleepless nights. That's the reward for your toil. That's what it's given you. And let's say you even have a nice nest egg that you're going to pass on to the next generation. What if they're just boneheads? You know, what if they just blow it? You know, what are you putting confidence in? It has to be something more than that. I mean, how do you even live now in light of these things? Well, that's where he comes to verses 24 through 26. So it's almost as if the lights come on. And all of a sudden, we're called to enjoy God's gifts. He's saying, so in light of this, here's the thing that you can enjoy. In light of this, eat, drink, and enjoy your work. Now, you might think, well, yeah, I've been saying that my whole life. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That is not what he's saying. I mean, look at what he's saying here. He's saying, eat, drink, and enjoy life. Why? Because God has given you that. God is the one behind this. You don't need to eat, drink, and be merry because that's what your soul really needs. You need to eat, drink, and be merry because God is the one who's given you that. That's the conclusion he's reached. That the answer is not the pleasures. The answer is not the toil. The answer is not, you know, having the right level of knowledge or wisdom. No, the answer is opening up your hands. What do I have that I didn't receive? God's given me this. God's the one. So apart from him, who can eat or have joy? So to those who, he wraps it up then, to those who live to please God, he gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But sinners, those who aren't going to live to please him, can expect toil that results in more toil. And toil in and of itself then leads to emptiness. That's the conclusion. If you're living your life for your work and that's the end, then no doubt, no, you are well right to be frustrated and irritated because that's all you have. But if you can receive your toil as a gift from God, that he has given me that, therefore I can eat, I can drink, I can enjoy life because I have a God that is good and gives me good things, then you're going to be able to surf through the toils of life in a way that's remarkably different than the world. The world eats and drinks and enjoys things because they feel like that's the payment that they're owed for the toil. The Christian eats, drinks, and enjoys because why wouldn't we with a God that gives us toil? That's kind of the difference in nuance. It's seeing God as the giver. And so we are not holding back. We can celebrate and feast like anyone else because of God, because of who he is. He's the hope. He's the confidence. And so all of that, in conclusion today, we've seen these three investigations into the toil of life. That the pursuit of wisdom doesn't satisfy, the pursuit of pleasures is fleeting, and toil without a view of God leads to emptiness. And so then the conclusion was to receive toil as a gift from God. So what gain is there from the work that you do in life? Whether it's your role as an employee in the home or even in your personal life, what profit is there from toil? Well, the answer to that is you don't have to give your life pursuing everything and figuring out the answer to that question. God's already done the work for you. God's already provided you biblical wisdom on this. Wisdom, pleasure, and toil are vanity in and of themselves. They'll never deliver. your work is never going to give you fulfillment. It's just going to take away your sleep and your energy. So, you'll be frustrated. You feel like it's striving after the wind. And have any of you ever felt that, like in your employment? But this is just striving after the wind. God, I'm just up again. Here we go. Chasing the wind. No end to this. No end to this. And on top of that, like we saw today in this passage, death is coming. So how about that good news, right? So not only are you going to exhaust yourself with toil, but death is coming. You can't take it with you, and you're not going to be able to. And all this passage is showcasing all these things. So how are you, this is the question of the passage. How are you going to live in light of this? Are you going to center your life more on pleasure? Are you going to choose to center your life more on getting more knowledge or wisdom? Are you going to center your life on your work and say, well, I just better be a better employee then? Is that where you're going to center your life? Or are you going to center your life in God? That's what this passage is driving you to. Will you center your life in Him? Because He's the ultimate giver of all these good things. He's the one who's given us everything to enjoy. In Matthew 12, Jesus spoke about Solomon's wisdom and about our response to it. And here's what He said in Matthew 12:42. This is insane. He says, "The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, someone greater than Solomon is here." So Jesus has come that you might have real life. Jesus is God's ultimate gift to this world. So you can receive His life. And you can receive all of His life flowing through you in your toil. I mean, you think Solomon got it. Jesus is saying, all those people that thought Solomon had all the wisdom, they're going to stand up and condemn you at the judgment because you didn't believe in Jesus. And He's greater than Solomon. I mean, He's the embodiment of wisdom, according to Colossians 2. And some of us need to just believe more deeply that God's a good giver. I mean, we've forgotten that. We think, again, this is, I think, let's see, American independence with a good Kansas Mennonite work ethic built into us, that what the world needs from us is a better employee. Or what the world needs is for me to just put my head down and do my work and not say anything. And we're trying to do all this. The reason why it's frustrating is because we're not doing that with an eye on God. We're not doing it with an eye on Him being the good giver. The model prayer invites us to pray to God, "Give us this day our daily bread." At the very core, at the very basic, that God can provide what we need and we can rest and find our contentment in what He's given. So that's why Jesus invites us to not worry. Remember that in Matthew 6? "Therefore I tell you, don't be anxious about your life, what you'll eat or drink, nor about your body, what you'll put on. Is not life more than food and your body and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them." He gives. "Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to your lifespan? And why are you anxious about clothing? Look at the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God can clothe the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will He not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore, don't be anxious, saying, 'What shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear?' For the Gentiles seek after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. But seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." Our Father loves to lavish good gifts on His children. So don't settle for the mediocre enjoyments of this world. And those mediocre enjoyments are exhilarating in the moment. I mean, if we tasted one-tenth of what Solomon had, our lives, we would be like, whatever. Like, I'm not even going to have a house here. I'm just going to live in a hotel the rest of my life. Whatever. Whatever. I mean, it would just be crazy and insane pursuing stuff. But our Father gives us good gifts. We can't settle for the mediocre enjoyments of this world. When you give your life for seeking the wisdom of the world, the latest pleasures, or even toil, it's chasing after the wind. Instead, lean into your Father. He's given good gifts to you, like food. He's given good gifts to you, like drink. He's given good gifts, like toil, to you. And all that he's given so that we can anticipate enjoying him, the one who's at his right hand are pleasures forevermore. This is not just a temporary thing. This is going to be eternal. He has pleasures forevermore. So let's seek him then and be a people who glorify and enjoy him forever.